Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris of Facts and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hulfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 4 of season 10. I've been using Boris of Facts products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with editor John Pohl and additional editor Karadine El-Halou. They've joined us to talk about The Color Purple. John's credits include Father of the Bride, Bombshell, The Greatest Showman, Meet the Fockers, and Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, among many others. Karadine has also been an additional editor on films like Father of the Bride and Black Hat, assistant editor on Power Rangers and Muppets Most Wanted, among others. Before I hop into our discussion with John and Karadine, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for Mac OS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris of Facts. I've been using Boris of Facts and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris of Facts is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris of Facts suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, John Pohl and Karadine El-Halou discuss editing The Color Purple. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me on Art of the Cut. It's great to have you both.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You had some pretty high-powered producers on this production, Steven Spielberg and Oprah. And I edited for Oprah for 10 years on her show. Tell me about the kind of notes you were getting from above the director and how those were affecting you and what you were dealing with.
Blitz was always incredibly open to collaboration, kind of with everyone. Certainly with Oprah and Scott and Steven, it was always an open door. To be honest, one of the things we focused on was getting the movie in front of them as quickly as we could. And I think it was 2 or 3 weeks into the director's cut that we sent them the movie because we wanted to start showing it to people. Scott and Oprah had some notes, but not quite as many as Mr. Spielberg. And I would have to say that Mr. Spielberg's notes were pretty much the best set of notes I've ever seen. They were actionable. They were practical. They were not development notes. They were things you could understand quickly. They were very filmmaker kinds of notes. And we got a lot of notes in the very beginning. And then a couple other times, and one time he came in and spent about 5 or 6 hours with Blitz and I, and he couldn't have been more generous. It was actually fascinating because he said, oh, I left my notes at the office. And he said, oh, let's not worry about it. Let's just watch the movie and we'll scroll through and I'll remember everything. You know, this is a man who's watching a completely new version of a movie that he made. You know, it is based on the book and it's based on the musical. It was a very interesting thing, I think, for him to do that. And he couldn't have been more generous and collaborative with Blitz.
As a lesson for young directors or anyone giving notes, what are some of those things that you can think possibly examples of actionable notes and non-development notes? What are some things that you can think of that you could share that you thought was a good note?
There's one specific note that really always stands out to me. Sometimes these things are things we might have found on our own. Blitz and I tried every note we got from anyone. And what that means for Blitz is trying it and not just looking at that section, but like watching the reel back and really taking it in. And we never would screen the movie for other people without having done that after trying things, first of all. Right before Suge arrives on the barge, there's a scene with Suge and Celie where she gives her a dress. Celie comes down the stairs. She's wearing makeup and this beautiful dress for the first time. Mr. is there looking at his watch. He can't wait to go see his girlfriend, Suge. Celie says, Suge wants us to go on ahead. She's going to make an entrance. And we used to have a scene of, you know, walking up to the juke and being inside the juke, anticipating Suge coming and seeing her a little bit from their point of view. And he said, why don't you guys just go right from she wants to make an entrance to her making the entrance. We were always trying to do little interesting sound things, and we managed to get the timing of him angrily closing his watch and sucking his teeth with the pre-lap of the snaps from the guys on the boat with Suge. So that's one that I always remember.
There would just be like little fine detailed notes you would even get. You know, what are the tails on that shot? You know, I'd love to stay with this character a little bit longer. He would even think like, oh, have you tried going over the shoulder and maybe throwing in an ADR line here? You know, like he just knew how to construct a scene, obviously.
One of the interesting things about notes that I think is something that everyone learns, hopefully, you shouldn't expect people to give you notes that solve your problems. The one I brought up, it wasn't really a problem. It just made it better. Notes are really a way of someone telling you there's something not working for them. And they're just going to throw out, well, what about this? What about that? And our job as filmmakers is to take those notes and then think about them and what was going on for the person and how do we solve that problem?
I love the idea. I don't know if he did it just as you said, but that it was asked as a question. What are the tails on that shot, right? Because you don't know. Maybe you cut out the exact frame that, you know, the camera bumps or something. But maybe there's more time there and maybe it'll be more powerful.
Right. And a lot of his notes really were, what about this? What about that? It's a very similar conversation that would happen if Carradine and I were sitting in a room going over a reel with Blitz.
There's been a couple iterations of this film, a book, a previous movie, and then a musical based on the movie or based on the book. Tell me about your research. Did you watch or read all of those things, none of those things, and why?
Early on, I listened to one song from the musical. I started listening to Alice Walker read The Color Purple on Audible, which it's only a 250-page book, but she takes 7 hours to read it. And I listened to that three times because I was just absorbing it, and the nuance and the way she would read lines gave me so much information into character. That combined with Blitz's unique take on the fantasies and what this whole movie would be really shaped everything for me. And I did ask Blitz, I said, I listened to one song from the play, but I've heard your versions of these songs now, and they're very different. Would you like me to watch the whole musical? And he said, do you want to? And I said, I'd rather kind of stay clean. I like having your vision of what this new movie is going to be and Alice's vision of what the book was. And that's really, for me, what was all my prep.
And did you rewatch Spielberg's movie?
I did way later in post. Obviously, I'd seen it years before. And I think we were near locking the movie and I watched it. But they're different animals. I mean, this was a movie that was standing, we hoped would stand on its own and would also work for people who read the book and also work in a different way for people who had seen Stephen's movie and in a different way for people who had seen the play. In my first meeting after getting the job, Blitz says, oh, I want to show you something. He said, I'm going to show you the movie. So it was 1,200 storyboards that Blitz had drawn himself. And they weren't storyboards like conventional storyboards. They were the storyboards that meant something specifically to him. And of course, had images, which you now see in the movie. But it wasn't like every scene was storyboarded. As he went through the movie, they were the moments that were important to him. And he had a little VFX previs in there and all the songs and dance numbers that he was shooting on his iPhone. So it was amazing. It was 2 hours, 2 hours, 15 minutes. I watched a movie, And I didn't realize it till afterwards. I figured Blitz is just sort of working while I'm watching it. And he said, oh, I watched you. I can tell where you got emotional. I could tell where you laughed. He did that with every department head. Carradine did not get the benefit of watching.
I saw it later. We had it in the Avid.
Oh, that's right. That's right. One of the things about Blitz that's so amazing is we all knew the movie we were working on. He was so clear.
Carradine just mentioned that the pre-film was in the Avid. Did you ever use portions of it as a placeholder or no?
In the very, very beginning, the first week or two, yes, actually, because I'm used to trying to fill things out as you get the movie going and put stills in, and just so you don't break the flow by cutting to black. And we tried that a little bit, and then quickly we abandoned it. It became more distracting. But one of the things that was interesting is, you know, sometimes you work on a movie and they send you all the storyboards. Blitz showed me and all the department heads the storyboards. He never brought them to the set. He never sent them to the cutting room. He never wanted to reference them. It was a way of him communicating basically what the movie was. It wasn't something to stick to.
I noticed a couple of transitions and specialty shots that were designed, like it seemed like very clear thought in production of how we're going to get from one scene to another. Does that handcuff you at all that, you know, you've got this great transition? There were clearly shots that matched from the end of one scene to the next scene.
Carradine, there's one exactly like that in a scene that you worked on. The transition from Give Me a Kiss.
Well, that was specifically designed from pre-production to production. So it really never changed. But that was one example of how Blitz's vision from the very beginning to the very end was completely in stone. And it's because it works perfectly. Like, there was no need to adjust it. But then as far as other transitions, even if Blitz did have the idea, I mean, it's not always rock solid. You know, you always find little things that you can improve on. And whether it's timing or elevating it with the sound design and working with the music. So we were constantly working on that aspect as far as transitions go.
One transition that I noticed that I wanted to know whether it was pre-planned or in post was there's a great transition from them watching Flying Aces to the fantasy scene with the piano, and there's the planes fly over, like the reflection of the planes fly over the... I thought that was great.
That is a perfect example of the reverse. So we had the movie Flying Aces, and that was always planned to be the movie. In prep, that was going to be the movie. It's a film that's a silent film with an all-black cast from the 20s. Suge is taking Celie to show her a wilder, wider world. Celie has never been in a movie theater. And here they are all dressed up and watching it, and Celie goes into that fantasy. We push into the screen. It was always designed to just go from the movie to the set, and there used to be a hanging prop plane in the back of the set. It didn't work as well as one would expect. Blitz had an amazing batting average on these transitions. The hard part was we had to make the transitions that we came up with work as well as his. And that was actually, I think it was Carradine and I and Blitz and Travis Dultz, our VFX editor, sitting in a room for about 2.5 hours, all of us spitballing. At some point, the idea came up, the piano is like a mirror. What if we just start on that top shot, which was never the way that scene was going to start, and see the plane fly over and pull out? I don't think anyone was really sure it would work. And a couple hours later, after Travis showed it to us, we were like, oh, we figured it out. It's one of those great things where, you know, we could have been there for 2 days trying to figure it out, but luckily we figured it out.
I was fortunate enough to have Ron Howard write the forward for my next book. And one of the things that he said was, which I just loved, was there are often problems that you have to solve in editing. And he said the great thing is when solving the problem doesn't just band-aid it, but makes it better, you know, is more cinematic. That transition just seems completely natural, as if it had been planned, which is what you're saying. The unplanned one has to look as good as the planned one.
Blitz and I, in the very beginning, talked about musicals in general. And we were trying from the get-go to do whatever we could to avoid the sometimes almost inevitable feeling of you're in a dramatic scene and then we're singing. You know, I told him Walk the Line in my interview. I said, you may not want to hire me. Walk the Line's my favorite musical, the Johnny Cash film. And I said, the story is told on the stage. A lot of people don't even call it a musical. And now I sit here 2 years later, and it's sort of, in an odd way, what we achieved. Every transition in the movie was analyzed and worked on. Carradine did so much sound effects work in the beginning that Julian Slater and Paul Massey and Renee Tondelli worked on and took us through the final mix. You know, most of those things came out of the cutting room in an experimentation and trying to weave in music. Julian had worked on Baby Driver. I'd worked with Renee a lot. She said, why don't we team up with Julian? So Julian mostly did sound effects and then mixed sound effects. Renee did a lot of stuff with Foley, and Paul Massey mixed dialogue and music. You can hear so many isolated things like hammers, horse hooves at the very beginning of the movie. You know, that's in Blitz's first pitch. We're on the logos and we're hearing the horse hooves. They're syncopating and they're creating music. And then that takes us to the tree with the girls playing patty cake. We spent a lot of time on our transitions.
One of my favorite transitions, actually, that was never meant to be a transition, actually, was when Celie finds the letters from Nettie. There is this montage of her reading back the letters and kind of visualizing and seeing the world that Nettie is living in. And that actually used to be scripted, and the way it was shot was you were going to like a Celie imagination, then she went back home and she was hiding letters, and then she like woke up the next day and then saw another imagination with another letter she was reading. And it was these individual scenes. And I remember early on we were sitting in a screening and you could kind of feel the audience moving a little bit. One thing that I think is really successful that John sort of, one of his first presentations to Blitz on like, how can we be the most successful early on, is show the movie as often as possible. So we almost had like screenings every week. Early on in those screenings, you could feel that like there was a rhythm missing there. We combined that area to then when they're in African homeland, when you arrive on the beach in Africa, one of the tribe members whips down a piece of cloth that takes you into a new letter and a new story. And that was actually a Blitz idea. But that was just like, it feels so in tune with the movie as far as the rhythm of the movie. And it creates a really cool transition. And I just, that's one of my favorite moments that kind of evolved through post-production.
Were there stems at all times for various pieces of music so you could do things?
Yeah, we were working with Nick Baxter, who was the music producer on this. And the interesting thing was we would get the song before they would film it just for us to have it ready. But even on the day of filming, they would sometimes change the song, or, you know, they would explore an extended version or a shorter version. And so once they were done filming, we would then try to get that bounce back. And then once we had the bounce, the stereo version of it, we would then request for additional stems, but it usually came from a John request. If John was like, you know, let's try to mix the horns a little bit differently here, or even Blitz. Blitz was coming in and he already wanted to start mixing the music in different ways. So it was usually in a way where it was a specific request if we wanted to like dive a little bit deeper, but usually that request came for every song by the end of it. With John and myself, we also don't love a timeline that is super clustered. So we wanted to have that flexibility, but we also didn't want an insane amount of audio tracks. And we were also working in LCR in the Avid. So, you know, we had our center channel and our left and right within the Avid. When you're broken down into stems and then you're also breaking down from center, left and right, you know, it can kind of build up very quickly. So we were trying to be resourceful as far as getting stems into the Avid.
John, you've worked with Carradine at least on your previous movie, if not other ones. Tell me a little bit about your relationship and the work that he was doing.
Well, I first met Carradine on the infamous Bruno. He was our PA. He was 20 years old. I just liked Carradine from the start. And then I ran into him on one of the Muppets movies after he'd gotten in the union. And then I hired him on a TV show that I was working on as an editor and a producer and a director, The Brink, a very funny dark comedy with Jack Black and Tim Robbins. Carradine actually edited the episode I directed with me. And then I think we worked on 7 or 8 things. There was a Vince Vaughn movie. There were a couple of other things. So we'd worked together a lot before Father of the Bride. Honestly, I was always trying to get him to come back. And Father of the Bride was great because honestly, Carradine is literally better at music than I am. And the real five in that movie was just a giant wedding with tons of music. And Carradine ended up adopting that reel. And I think it was a great experience. And Gaz Alazraki, director, loved working with him. And Blitz loved having Carradine around. There's something wonderful about the geometry of three people in a cutting room. I've always found that. And it's always been really helpful. Like I used to work with Greg Hayden and Craig Alpert, who went on and are editors, great editors in their own right. And it was always interesting. Those were movies with Jay Roach. Having three people creates a different dynamic than a director and editor who then may have two different opinions. It really creates more of a conversation. And Carradine was kind of in the middle of that at all times and had lots of opportunities to work alone with Blitz.
I'm struck by the fact that you basically just said, I just like hanging out with him. And most of the people that we work together like hanging out. How important is that social aspect in getting a job and keeping a job as an assistant, for example?
You know, every cutting room is different. And, you know, there are some cutting rooms where there's like a real hierarchy. Early on, I worked in a cutting room as an assistant where, the editor had come from New York, had worked with a very well-known New York editor. I was told on the first day, you talk to the apprentice, she doesn't talk to me, and then you talk to me. And I was like, wow, okay, that's a different way of doing things. For me, we are all giving up a part of our lives to give to the art we're working on. Hopefully you're lucky enough to create a family. And I think that's something we had with our core group of people. And I've been lucky enough to have it other times. I think we're all good friends. The way Carradine was a PA is the way Carradine is an editor. And you can see that in a person right away. You know, sometimes you have a PA who's like, I don't want to just get coffee. You know, why am I getting lunch? When someone asks, hey, could you get me a cup of coffee? Tells you a lot.
John has given me great opportunities. And I feel like my job is to help John however I can, you know, make him look good, make Blitz look good, you know, make the movie look great. So I just try to give as much as I can. I love the collaboration process. So, you know, what John was saying about the team of the three of us, you're able to get a lot done. And you're able to explore a lot more. And that conversation aspect, I think, elevates the movie. To go beyond just the three of us, John and Blitz were also very inclusive as far as everyone in editorial. I mean, when we were in dailies, after lunch, John would be like, hey, guys, come in. I want to show you a scene. And it would be myself and Joe Binford, our assistant, and our PA, Issa, and we would, and Travis, the VFX editor. We would all sit in John's room, watch a scene, and John would be like, what do you think? It would be a conversation. John took every thought to heart and explored ideas based on our conversations. And I think the movie just gets better when you're able to have that process.
So while we're talking to you, Carradine, tell me a little bit more about what you did on the film, what your responsibilities were as an assistant, and then also kind of as an editor as well.
I started as the first assistant editor. In the very beginning, it was a matter of setting John up and getting editorial set up with our other assistant, Joe Binford, in Atlanta, and just making sure we were getting dailies to John as soon as possible. And it was also a matter of, I hadn't had the chance to actually build that relationship with Blitz. So that took time to sort of build that rhythm with Blitz. But Blitz was coming in a lot during production. Some weeks it was every day, and then some weeks it was like once a week, but he was very active as far as coming in before a shoot or after a shoot. And so we started to even work on the director's cut while we were still in production. And so when that happens, it's like, not only are you dealing with dailies, but then you're also helping John with the notes he just got from Blitz. So my role was to facilitate a lot of that and help John get to his goals. But then as Blitz was coming in, John was introducing me to Blitz or giving me that opportunity to work with Blitz and being like, you know, Carradine took a crack at something here. There's something interesting. Do you maybe want to explore that with Carradine? And John is the one who would set that up and give me that FaceTime with Blitz. And then from there, it was on me to kind of prove to Blitz that I was in tune with his vision, that I understand, you know, understood what the movie needed. Obviously, it's a huge thing to get the approval of John, but, you know, I still have to earn that sort of approval from Blitz. And so that happened towards the end of production. You know, we'd gotten enough FaceTime with Blitz that, like, as we were going into the director's cut, it was still John all the time. But John, I had at least built that relationship with Blitz where it became very collaborative and it was a great opportunity.
Did you and Blitz have any discussions before the film started about what he wanted or vision or what he was looking for you to do while he was off shooting?
Blitz did his best to make sure that everyone understood what the movie was. Our very first discussion was the idea that, yes, this movie has incredible hardship for Celie and Sophia. They have to live with that. But the movie's not about that. We don't shy away from it. We don't speed through it. But the movie is about overcoming that. And in order to do that, the important thing in the movie is, yes, of course, all the big scenes and fantasies and musical numbers are important, but it really all lies in the chemistry of these intimate, personal, elegant and grounded. Those were Blitz's two words I heard on day one, elegant and grounded. For a director, the most important thing is to know that the editor understands the tone and your intention. And if you're in sync, of course you're going to make changes. You're always going to make changes. You're going to change takes. You're going to do things like that. But I think early on, we all knew the movie we were making. I don't think you could work with Blitz and not know the movie you're making.
It's a question about macro pacing of the whole movie. Talk about the need in the first act to have things move along, right? First acts are always a little sloggy, right? But you do have to develop that loss and the relationship between the two girls. So how do you do both? How do you have all this character stuff and sadness and relationship and, you know, and move things along?
Well, hopefully we found it. Almost every movie I've ever worked on, you know, an audience in a focus group, someone says, takes too long to get going. And then someone else always says, it takes too long to wrap it all up. Why are there so many endings? I mean, that kind of happens on almost every movie. We easily could have had a 3-hour first cut. We did not, because 2 days a week, I was doing director's cut notes. The rest of the time I was cutting new material. But I knew that Blitz could come in anytime and I wanted to have everything there for him. Our approach was, yes, we don't want a 3-hour movie, but we're never going to rush through anything. We're going to let the important scenes play out. And in fact, a lot of the musical numbers are not as cutty as you'll find in, you know, many other musicals today. And there's a lot of oners. Certainly the first act was probably trimmed more than other acts were. You know, the third act, when the movie's really going and you've got these long musical numbers, we've set all that up and it's working, even though that's kind of long. And the beginning, look, it's hard. There's difficult things to watch, many of them. And the most important thing for us there was, besides establishing Celie and what she had to go through, was establishing the relationship between the sisters, because 2 hours later, we, with different actresses, we had to feel like these sisters are reunited and it's kind of everything to them. I mean, it's what the whole movie is leading to. And even though most people have read the book or seen the film or seen the musical, we still get an amazing reaction when Nettie shows up at the final Easter dinner.
That's how you know that your setup worked, right? Because the payoff works.
We were just careful about kind of every frame, every moment, so that we would have a movie that would be an entertainment, a legitimate entertainment, but also have a lot of emotion and tell a difficult story. But even though it's a difficult story, it's really a story about how Sophia and Shug combine to support and lift up Celie and let her become such a full person, which I think in this iteration of the story, she comes through as surviving and succeeding and thriving. She's found love. She's using her skills and she opened a business. look who's wearing the pants now.
I wanted to talk about the editing, which I loved in Push the Button. Can either one of you talk to me a little bit about that song, preparation of it, things you had, dailies?
Now there's something about good loving that all you ladies should know. If you want to light your man on fire, you gotta start it real slow. Keep on turning up the voltage till that man begin to glow, like you're switching on a light bulb. Watch the juice begin to flow.
Taraji P. Henson takes over the movie. It's Seeley's movie, but when Sophia comes on screen, she takes over the movie for a little while. It's like the baton is passed. And Suge does the same thing. So that's probably the cuttiest musical number in the movie. And it's basically because she did so many different things that Blitz and I wanted to include. She just had so much energy. That's a scene that we actually bothered Nick Baxter for. I think all of these scenes.
Yeah, we ended up.
Don't get mad. And he kept going, we do this later. And I was like, no, we're going to show people the movie. I'm showing Blitz the movie. I'm watching the movie. We're going to do it now.
The interesting thing with Blitz's production style is, I mean, he really didn't lean on a B or C camera. I mean, it was there every now and then, but a lot of times A camera was the main goal. So there wasn't like a ton of like super groups or anything like that. If you have these like massive super groups, it gets overwhelming and sometimes you miss stuff. I think John is someone who's like constantly combing through the dailies, and it's just easier if you just have it in a traditional AB setup kind of stuff.
Can you stop for a second and explain to people who are not used to supergroup or grouping how the organization in the bin might affect the editor's ability to find stuff or see stuff?
So a supergroup example would be, you know, you have your song, you sync every piece of take and every setup to that song. And when you play it in the Avid, you can potentially be looking at like 16 small images that are technically in sync. And it's kind of cool, but it's also a little overwhelming. Some movies require that because there just is so much, or they like shoot a ton of cameras. Every movie and every scene is different, but we didn't really run into that.
When you're organizing the bin for John to look at, has he asked for anything? And two, how do you organize something, you know, with all this extra players and, oh, we might want to show somebody off at a table stomping their foot or clapping their hands, but really the main show is Taraji. And how do you lay that out in a bin for him?
So we'll typically just have the bin set up where it matches the production paperwork. And John can use that as a reference because there's usually like the script notes and, you know, a description of what's going on. So I think that is the cleanest way for John to navigate the material, and it's worked for us.
I'm also really annoying because I'm impatient and I come in early in the morning. So I really just want it set up in alphabetical order, clean, keep it as simple as possible so I don't have to move it around, get it to me so I can start working.
The other thing that we do that we have been doing is using Scripter as well.
Avid Script Sync.
Yeah, so we had someone helping us with that. That was easy for John if Blitz was specifically like, oh, and there's third part of the song, I'd love to, you know, find a different take. You then can get into the Scripter page, and obviously John will have all his options there. So that's where that came in handy as far as being specific and looking for specific areas.
And was there anything in Script Sync that you added beyond the lyrics to the song? Because I would think the only thing in Script Sync is the lyrics to the song.
Yeah. I mean, if there's specific action beats, we would write those in. You can also edit the page, the script page. So if there's specific action beats that are helpful for John and seem like something that, oh, you'll probably want to look at different versions of this, you know, we can write that in. Or if it's a dialogue scene, we're always trying to mark alt lines. If a character is saying something funny that's not scripted, you definitely want to save that and make sure that John can find it or go back to it later if it comes up.
Part of Blitz's process, he worked very closely with his script supervisors. There were two of them. And he told me that after they shot a scene, they would sit and watch all the takes, or maybe all the ones that they thought they liked. And he almost always picked a couple takes and said, these are my favorite. And that was always a good starting point.
That is interesting, though, that they watched it after the shooting, because I find that when people are watching during the shooting, their choices are not necessarily good.
Blitz was like, please look at these first and know these are the ones I like. It was a different kind of process, and it was very helpful. You know, there's so many different ways to do this, and you find yourself, when you're working for a director, you want to work the way they like to work. Like, very quickly, I learned that Blitz needs to really assess things. We would go through a reel at a time most of the time. We wouldn't just watch a scene. But there were days where I would come in at 5 in the morning, and like at 7:30 at night, I'm like, oh, wow, I'm tired. I'm going to go home. But I got to call Eden, Blitz's assistant, and she'd go, oh, we're going to wrap in a half hour. He'll be in at 9:30. And there were often times where he would just show up in the morning because it was a split day and his call was at noon. So at 9 a.m., he'd just walk in there. What that really did for us is he's seen these versions of scenes. I don't need to like make a big deal and go, I have a new idea and I want to pitch it to you. I would just keep showing him the movie. Every time he came in, he said, I don't want to take notes at home and send you notes. I want to come in. I want to watch in real time with you and then sit and talk about what we're going to do with everything. And of course, sometimes I would surprise him and he'd go, oh no, you can't do that. That's my wonder. You can't cut that up. But, you know, eventually, maybe a few weeks later, Blitz would go, you know, that thing you did where you cut up my wonder? Let's look at it one more time. Because, you know, he can say, put it back, leave it in. And often he'd go, you know, I remember that now. Let's look at it for a couple of weeks. And the current cut of the scene I'm thinking of right now, which is Seeley cleaning, is in the movie that way.
Seeley cleaning was a wonder?
Yeah. There's a little montage of five shots that's like,
oh, I totally remember that.
It was a beautiful wonder. I always thought Dan Lawson would shoot me for this. It was like a minute and 15 seconds and it took you all through the house. I mean, it was beautiful. And so Blitz started laughing. We're playing back the reel and I'm like, what are you laughing at? What's going on? He said, I'm laughing at the fact that at one point in time, I told you, how dare you? You can never do. I mean, he didn't really say how dare you, but you know, you can't do this. And then there were some times where he said, you can't do this. And I have a little rule, you know, I'll ask something once, twice, never more than three times. What was important to him was the interaction and the discussion, the collaboration, to be honest. I had never heard this during production, but during a couple of the Q&As, we had a Q&A with like eight people up there. And he said, look, I can't do what Dan Lawson does. I can't do what Paul Osterberry, the production designer, does. I can't do what Fatima, the choreographer, does. I can't do what Francine, the costumer, does. I can't do what John does, editing. I'm the conductor. And he said, it's my job to tell everyone what we're doing and to keep the rhythm. And he's being very modest in that, but he's not wrong. We're all there to service the movie. And he gave us a lot of room. And part of an editor's role is challenging a director. Carradine actually terrified me at one point during this last movie where he said, you know, I've never seen anybody else challenge a director like you do. And I was like, wait, what? And he was like, no, but in a good way. And I think that is an important thing. I think it's really helpful because a director always has what's in their mind and it's up to them what goes in the movie. If you got a bunch of editors sitting around a table talking, they would all say the most important thing is that the director has a clear vision. And the second thing that they would say is a director who is open to collaboration and new ideas. And those are the two things that matter. And Blitz embodied those very well. And could hold them together. It was never about his ego or his way. It was always what's best for the movie.
Carradine, tell me a little bit about this idea of challenging the director and what you learned from that or how that terrified you. Because I do think it's very important to push a director and he should push you. You know, he should challenge. I don't think that's the way this should get cut together. That's great. I want to hear that from a director. Okay. I thought it was right when I did it, but let's talk about it.
A director comes in with a very strong vision. If maybe a scene isn't firing on all cylinders, a director I've heard sometimes will reference the script and what the intention of the scene was, and we'll go a little bit deeper into like, well, you know, the way this all came about. And it's almost at one point, it's like, but sometimes it's hard for a director to kind of see where you're just currently at and what the footage is and what the scene plays as, because in their own head, they have a reference to the very beginning of how this scene sort of came about.
Which the audience will never have.
Exactly, 100%. But I, to be fair to a director, I think it's sometimes hard to have that clear vision. And I think as an editor, that's the opportunity where you can jump in and be like, I think there are ways to maybe address this or elevate this or, you know, whatever it is. And I've seen John be able to present alternatives that maybe don't land the first time, but over time, the director will come back to it. It's something that I think either John, you know, will remind them or, you know, they'll remember, or, you know, it's like John's three rule, you know, I've seen John pitch an idea three times after, you know, hearing no. You never know. Every scenario is different, but it's just an interesting ability that I think an editor can really help a director kind of get to the finish line.
Isn't it interesting to you to see the process that things are not, and you've been around editing long enough at this point and seen enough, been in enough editing rooms, that it's a process, that there are scenes that don't fire on all cylinders, and it doesn't mean that's the way they're going to end up in the final film, right? That you're going to get there.
We showed this movie a lot, and it did get better. We saw the comments afterwards and the emotional impact that it had, and it's pretty amazing to witness it over time.
You mentioned script sync or scripter, as some people call it. John, where do you fall in using that? Are you more on the side of using script sync in your editing with the director and not so much building a scene?
I've worked on a lot of comedies, and I think in a comedy, it's the most helpful because you also have written in all the alternate lines. It was helpful on this film, but I never really want to cut from that and just compare takes. I'd rather watch, take notes, know what I like, know what Blitz likes, and then just go with my gut and put it together. You know, it's mostly good for me to go back through and check performances if I'm not sure of something. Blitz goes, just double check. Is there something that's, you know, a little more this or a little more that? Is he a little tougher here? And it's useful there. But honestly, I think on Color Purple, there's less leaning on it, you know, than on a movie like Meet the Parents.
I just want to give a shout out to the crew that we worked with in editorial. So Joe Binford in Atlanta and Issa, our PA, and Dana, who helped out as well. And then in LA, Petra Demas, who was huge for us as well. And then Steven Rickard. There was just a lot. And then Bernardo and Kay Barnes, our PAs. There was just so many people that helped bring this movie together.
Leslie Rodier.
And Leslie, yeah. Leslie was the spearhead of it all, taking us through it.
Leslie's last name again?
I think she pronounces it Rodier, and I pronounce it the French way, Rodier.
But anyways, there was just a giant team that had a huge impact on this movie. And so, you know, just a huge thank you to all of them.
Yes, yes. We would not have gotten there without this extended family we had.
There's a big dinner scene, and anybody who's an editor knows that dinner scenes are a nightmare, at least table scenes, multiple people. I think so. Can you talk to me about working through that scene?
This movie's unusual because the movie's 2 hours, 20 minutes long. You take out the credits, 2 hours, 10 minutes long. There's like an hour and 5 minutes of dialogue scenes. And this is the longest dialogue scene in the movie. There's another scene at the end that has a lot of people in it, but this is the one where there's 8 people there. They're all sitting around a table in a movie where there's camera movement almost everywhere. You know, dinner table scenes are a little different. For me, it's the kind of the most important scene in the movie because you come into that scene. Sophia has gotten out of jail. The most vibrant person in the movie is mute. Celie is about to leave town. She's not going to announce it herself, but Suge is going to say, we're going to Memphis. We're taking Celie. Mister has Celie out him for hiding the letters from Nettie. Harpo has Sophia there, his wife, but his girlfriend Squeak is there. You know, everyone comes in, and cutting the scene, you have to know at all times what all of those different people are thinking. Cutting the scene, I ended up, first pass was kind of, let's really get Sophia's backbone of the scene in. And then, you know, I'd go back through the dailies and focus on different things. Celie didn't have a lot to say until like halfway through the scene. And I felt a lack of her. And so I was trying to put in shots of her looking like she was worried. What's going to happen? What's Shug going to say? Just so you had the anticipation of it. You had old Mr. just watching. All he's going to do is say horrible things about the women the whole time. Even there are tiny things like, can we get a little more agency for Squeak leaving? And I think the last change I made in that scene was a little shot of Squeak looking to the door and then looking back before she gets up. And it was something I didn't even know if other people would notice. Obviously, Blitz sees all these things and goes, yeah, I like that. I'm not sure about that. I like that one. Even Renee Tondelli, our sound supervisor, said, wow, I caught that one change. That made such a difference. And in a scene like that, all those little reactions really make a huge difference. And then every single person is different after that scene. The whole movie changes. The surprising thing about that scene, and maybe the movie in general, is that there's quite a bit of humor. John Baptiste has a couple great lines. Harpo has a couple shrugs and like eye rolls, like I can't believe what Seeley's doing, that get a reaction. And what I love about that is we're not going for laughs, but this whole movie is about tension, creating tension. And if you have a laugh that takes away the tension and releases it, you can then build it back up again. And that's what makes that 5-minute scene work, I think, besides all these amazing performances and all these stories happening at once. But it's very satisfying for me when that scene plays and people are moved by it, entertained by it, and surprised by it. It's just a scene I always looked at. How can this be stronger? How can we make any of these characters stronger? Because sometimes you have a scene with 8 people and a couple of them disappear. I don't think anyone disappears in this scene, even if they hardly have any lines. I'm trying to keep everyone alive. I would hope that when that scene ends, everyone knows what was going on emotionally for each of those people. And one thing Blitz told me later on that was one of his favorite things in that scene, things would happen and I would cut to people having different reactions. So when Sophia comes alive and she hasn't said a word, she hasn't lifted her head, and Squeak is the first person, she's just chuckling. She's, oh, you know, this is funny. You know, she's younger. It plays kind of as an innocent reaction. And then you cut to Shug, who's like looking over at her. And so is Grady, John Baptiste. Like, this is really strange. Why are you laughing? And Blitz said what he liked about that is it kept both the kind of directions of how a person would react watching the scene in the scene. And that's the beauty. I love dinner scenes. And they are very difficult to cut because they need more love than most scenes. There are so many different ways to handle it.
Before I let you go, John, and Carradine, what's an important takeaway that you took from this film?
You know, at the end of this whole process, I know this movie changed me. I learned a lot. It really did change who I am and how I look at things. And I've never felt so much emotion watching a movie, so many, even all these times. I feel so fulfilled now that people are seeing the movie and people who we didn't know, who had nothing to do with the movie, who paid their $15 or $17 to see it, are having the same emotions that those of us who got to work on the film had. As an editor, I've never really worked on a movie that had this much emotion. I've worked on a lot of great movies, and comedies are great too. But the way this feels at the end, it feels like we can all survive. If Seeley can get through this, how can we not?
Seeing how the story, The Color Purple, resonated with a universal group of people in the sense that everyone was affected and felt the movie in a very special way, in the sense that obviously The Color Purple is very important for Black culture. But when we went to show the movie to people who weren't necessarily Black, and we tried to find those different communities and see how the movie played, it had the same effect. And the story just resonates in a human way. You know what I mean? It has this really special human spirit of this underdog that rises. And it was really rewarding to kind of see that happen.
Carradine, John, thank you so much for your time. Great chatting with you.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Appreciate it.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening.
Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to John Pohl and Karadine Al-Halu for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.